Iranian citizens have taken to the streets in protest of their government's role in the shooting down of a Ukrainian jet.
Now you're seeing widespread protests in several cities, telling the clerics basically to get lost, challenging the supreme leader, the ultimate authority in Iran.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for January 14th, we'll check in on how these protests have brought international attention to the region. We'll also look at a new rule prohibiting protests during the Olympics. Plus, in a year when a number of women and people of color told their stories on the screen, the Oscars are once again so white and so male. But we begin in Iran. Protesters are back in the streets of Iran after the country's leaders admitted to shooting down a Ukrainian passenger jet, killing 176 people. The Iranian government had originally denied responsibility for the downed jet, but several days later blamed the attack on human error from the Iranian military. As renewed anti-regime protests take off in Tehran, Iranian police have reportedly started firing live rounds to break up the gatherings. President Trump has highlighted the unrest in Iran, tweeting in support of protesters in both English and Farsi, and the situation in Iran has also brought increased international attention to the region. For more, I'm joined by Robin Wright, a Wilson Center Distinguished Fellow and columnist at The New Yorker. Robin, great to have you back.
Great to be with you always.
Tell us, the police have been firing at protesters. Have there been any casualties so far? How have the protesters been responding to the pushback?
Needless to say, the press has not been allowed into the country. Those who were there for the immediate aftermath of the death of General Soleimani have been asked to leave. So the reporting is sketchy. But there have been reported casualties. The numbers vary widely from a few to many. This is a really striking development, given the passions that poured out on the streets just a week ago to commemorate the death of General Soleimani and show support for the government. And now you're seeing widespread protests in several cities, telling the clerics basically to get lost, challenging the supreme leader, the ultimate authority in Iran, and escalating the stakes. Iran next month marks its 41st anniversary of the revolution, and it also goes to the polls to elect a new parliament. This could shape very much the next political phase in Iran as well.
You mentioned that this is a marked shift from where the country was just a week ago. And I'm wondering, these protests are including some more conservative voices who typically support the Iranian government. What caused that shift? What do you think it was that sparked what we're seeing today?
Iranians are a very proud people. It's a country that goes back more than five millennia. And it is the political leaders that infuriate them. I think the interesting dynamic here is that Soleimani had been deemed a hero, someone who was protecting them. And you will find some of the same people who were out at both the commemoration for Soleimani and the protests. There is a general anger at the government for its mismanagement and corruption, and a general fatigue with the ideology. A lot of Iranians just want to get on with life. And this is a time that I think the leadership is going to know that it has to get its act together or it will face much bigger protests.
Robin, we also know that this incident has gone beyond Iranian-U.S. relations and has now gotten the attention of the EU most recently, which met, a number of countries in the EU met to sort of decide how they were going to handle the latest news. And they've activated something called a dispute mechanism. Tell us what that is.
Well, this relates to the 2015 nuclear deal signed by the world's six major powers. And President Trump walked away from that deal unilaterally in May 2018. For a year, Iran complied, even though it was not getting the economic benefits. When the United States reimposed sanctions, that made it difficult for Iran to get what it expected as its half of the deal, and that was investment, business, and development. So in May 2019, it began a series of breaches, rolling back its commitments. The latest, just a couple of weeks ago, it announced it would no longer limit the number of centrifuges, which are important to produce a fuel that can be used either for nuclear weapons or peaceful nuclear energy. And Europeans have stood by watching all of these breaches, and they feel the fate of the nuclear deal itself is now at stake. So they have complained to the Joint Commission set up as part of the nuclear deal, which gives them 60 days then to sort out. And Iran, if it continues to unravel, to backtrack from its pledged limits, that could lead for the Europeans to join the United States in sanctions. Now, the Europeans are saying they still want to commit. They still believe that it's important for all parties, including the United States, to be back at the table to keep up with the commitments made. But this marks a real turning point and is the second big threat to the future after the U.S. walking away from it.
Robin, we've seen countries like Canada who had passengers on board the Ukrainian plane that are going to be meeting to discuss how to follow up on Iran's admission to shooting that plane down. What do we expect will come out of that talk?
Well, it's not clear. The Canadians do want some kind of compensation for the families of the victims, kind of normal things that happen after a plane crashes. But the shooting down of the plane actually may have more impact in changing both the internal and international dynamics of where Iran is right now. If it had just been limited, the kind of tensions, to the U.S. shooting of General Soleimani and the Iranian retaliation, followed by de-escalation, that chapter might have closed. But the shooting down of the plane has generated a whole sequence of events. It hardened the international community's response to Iran, and certainly Iranians have taken to the streets. They're embarrassed and angry at their government, and it may have more long-term consequences to the regime than the week-long tensions over the death of General Soleimani.
And finally, in your latest piece for The New Yorker, you say that the killing of Soleimani has undermined the Trump administration's goals in the Islamic Republic. Briefly, what do you mean by that?
The Trump administration has long sought a broader, bigger deal with Iran to prevent not just its nuclear program, but to cover other issues such as the missile tests, the intervention in the region, support for extremist groups. Trump wanted Iran back at the table. And that may well be harder to orchestrate now that the two countries have had military action and the U.S. has assassinated what was a very popular figure in Iran. And it also may make it harder on the nuclear front unless the U.S. is willing to take action itself to get Iran to end its provocations on the nuclear program. We're at a point that both sides want diplomacy, but neither side wants to take that dramatic first step. Meanwhile, protests rage on in Iran.
Robin Wright is a Wilson Center Distinguished Fellow and columnist at The New Yorker. Robin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and we're back with The Takeaway, taking a trip with you back to 1968, a year that saw this Rascal song hit number one. People got to be free was a sentiment that was shared by a lot of movements. It's been more than 50 years since athletes Tommy Smith and John Carlos raised their fists in a Black Power salute at the 1968 Summer Olympics in Mexico City. The two American sprinters won gold and bronze medals respectively and used the opportunity to protest racial discrimination as they stood on the Olympic medal stand. And it's exactly that form of protest that the International Olympic Committee wants to ban at this summer's Olympic Games in Tokyo. Last Thursday, the IOC published new rules governing how and when athletes can protest at the 2020 Olympics. The rules would prohibit everything from, quote, political hand gestures like raising a fist to taking a knee. For more now, I'm joined by Amira Rose Davis, an assistant professor of history at Penn State University and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Amira, great to have you back on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Also with us is Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of The Edge of Sports podcast. Dave, thanks for being with us as always.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Amira, how much did sponsorship and advertising factor into the IOC's decision here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's you can't dismiss it. It's the Olympics. They're a mega sporting event. They're all about corporate sponsorships. This year, they're projected to have over $6 billion dollars in sponsorship. And I think that selling this idea of political neutrality makes it easier to sell sponsors that this is a place that they want to invest their time and money in. You can never not follow the money when it comes to the Olympic Games.
Dave, how is the IOC defining political in this context?
They're leaving this very vague and very threatening, but basically what they're saying is any gestures on the field or on the pitch or on the medal stand. I mean, and specifically referencing any sort of raised fist, taking a knee, anything we associate with that kind of protest, which usually takes place when national anthems are playing. That's what they want to erase from the Olympic experience.
Amira, are there consequences if an athlete breaks one of these rules? Because we were talking about that yesterday, thinking, what happens if you have a similar situation to athletes, you know, taking a knee or raising a fist or doing any of these things? Is someone going to come out and take them off the medal stage?
Yeah, again, it's left very vague. It opens them up for case-by-case discipline from both the IOC, their National Olympic Committee, and International Federation. So I think the vagueness is intentional. It's telling them that there's no depth of what they can do to you, and that you're subject to it threefold. And so there's not really clear answers much of anywhere here.
Dave, was there an increased concern about the potential for protests given the taking a knee Colin Kaepernick started? I mean, is that why the IOC also might be taking this approach, that they're just trying to ward off anything that they think, you know, is gaining momentum?
Well, they certainly have increased concern because we are in an era where there's a more politicized athlete who is more likely to use this kind of stage to make a political statement. And in 2016, there was an Olympian from Ethiopia named Feyisa Lilesa, who made a gesture from the silver medal platform in solidarity with his people back home who are dealing with ethnic oppression. So, and at recent international events, there was a fencer named Rayson Bowden who took a knee. There was a swimmer named Anthony Irvin who raised a fist. So these events had been taking place and building steam. And I do think that they were worried that in 2020, you would see a real fruition of that, particularly reaching some of the more high profile sports.
I'm wondering here, what have the athletes had to say about this? Amira, do we know? Are they speaking out?
Yeah, certainly. So we've heard from Megan Rapinoe, who obviously has her own history of protests. She said, "We will not be silenced." That's one of the more profile, high-profile athletes. We've also heard from Gwen Berry, who is a hammer thrower. And if you remember, she protested at the Pan Am Games this past August. She raised her fist during the anthem. She also spoke out against the ruling and saying that she felt like this was about control and silencing. And I think it's important to note, though, that a lot of these Olympic athletes, a lot of the rosters for the Olympics have yet to be set. So, for instance, Gwen Berry is making these statements, but she hasn't officially made the Olympic delegation, the Olympic team that's going over to Tokyo. So it's a tricky position for many athletes who have yet to make a team commenting on the ruling. But we've heard some voices already kind of speaking out against it.
And to your point, I mean, Megan Rapinoe is almost untouchable given this summer's World Cup domination by the U.S. team. So it might be a little bit more of a risk for athletes who aren't on the rosters yet. Dave, last summer we spoke to Dr. Harry Edwards after the take a knee had taken off, and he was the lead organizer behind the protest that we mentioned at the top of the segment, the 1968 Summer Olympics with Tommy Smith and John Carlos. You just spoke with John Carlos. What did he tell you about his experience in the aftermath of that protest, Dave?
Well, that's actually not what we talked about. I mean, we've talked about that in the past, and the aftermath of his protest in 1968, I can tell you, was people colluded against him. He was ostracized from the Olympic movement. He had trouble supporting his family. There was a real payback for what he did. But as he's always said to me, he said, "I have no regrets for what I did 50 years ago. The people who have regrets are the people who did nothing." What I asked him the other night, last night, was about what he thought of this new rule. And he really gave no quarter to it. He said, "This is nonsense. They're way out of line with this. They're trying to take people's rights away, and it's ridiculous. They are saying that they don't want politics at the Olympics, but this is a political move. The silencing of people is political. We all love the Olympics, but I'm not sacrificing my humanity to win a medal." That's what he said to me.
Amira, what do you think it means for an organization like the Olympics to bury political speech like this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's awful. I think Nancy Armour had a great piece yesterday where she called it the height of hypocrisy. As John said, as Dave alluded to, the Olympics is inherently political. Flags and anthems are political. I mean, just this past fall, the South Korean government asked the IOC to ban the Japanese Rising Sun flag because it is a offensive reminder of colonial atrocities. And so to believe that this is a depoliticized speaks or a neutral space is just, I think, living in a kind of la-la land.
And I'm wondering, Amira, you know, to that point, I mean, there are also, we talked a little bit about this earlier, about the IOC wanting to make sure it doesn't upset its advertisers. But what about athletes? I mean, athletes that do well at the Olympics stand to gain their own advertisers and endorsement deals. Do you think that athletes might also be worried about losing those if they are too political?
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that athletes have been stuck in a negotiation with the IOC over where they can display their own sponsors while they're at the Olympics. And I think that, you know, part of what happened here is that the IOC funneled this through their athletic commission. They're the ones who released this document. And so I think it's a way of trying to shield itself by saying, well, athletes are asking for clarity. We're giving them clarity. We're all on board here. But individual athletes who are taking calculated risks to either speak up or stay silent, I think their sponsorship and endorsement deal certainly comes into play when you're talking about that. And we've seen repercussions. We've seen people like Gwen Berry lose sponsorship. We've seen the repercussions that come when you dare to speak up.
And Dave, do you think an athlete's history of protesting could factor into whether or not they make it to the Olympics down the road? I mean, this isn't the last Olympics.
Well, yeah, but the athletic peak of an athlete, you know, can only be in a really certain window. So athletes are taking a tremendous risk if they're not a Megan Rapinoe, if they're not already on the team. They are playing with the idea that they've trained their whole life. Yeah, for maybe 10 seconds, and they could be risking those 10 seconds by speaking out. I think that the thing about this rule that's particularly disturbing is exactly how opaque it is. I mean, they talk about that they're trying to bring clarity to the issue, but is this really clarity to say we're going to decide this on a case-by-case basis, that punishments are going to be left up to individual federations in consultation with the IOC? I think it actually is a much more threatening situation now than it was before they put this rule down.
And of course, Amira, this week we also saw Iran's only female athlete, Kamia Alizadeh, announced that she was defecting from Iran and she would not be representing the country in the 2020 Games. How does that move fit into the conversation we're having about the political nature of the Olympics? Isn't that inherently political?
Yeah, certainly. And I think, you know, to Dave's point, one of the things that is really upsetting about the threat here and the move for control is that many athletes use this moment because it is the platform or is the space in which they can either affect change, give rise to an issue, or for their own personal reasons, defect or get out of a situation in their country. And, you know, when we think about 68, one of the things that Dr. Harry Edwards and John and Tommy said is we made this stand because we couldn't go to the UN and be heard in that way. And so the platform that global games give athletes is really important. And this defection is in line with other moments that we've seen like that. Dave mentioned earlier the Ethiopian runner. And if you remember, in the wake of his protest against the treatment of the Oromo people, he stayed in Rio and he made his way to the States in order to be protected. And so I think that that's, you know, something to certainly keep in mind. The threat on this speech is also just a threat on athletes in general and a destruction of a platform that has been so important over the years.
It's a huge media event, and of course, we will be watching. Amira Rose Davis, Assistant Professor of History at Penn State and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Dave Zirin is Sports Editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you.
And finally, all voting members of the Academy have nominated the following films for Best Picture.
The Oscar nominations came out yesterday, and once again, Oscar's so white and male. But it wasn't supposed to be this way. The hashtag OscarSoWhite caught fire in 2015 after no people of color were nominated in any of the year's acting categories. In response to growing pressure to increase diversity, the governing board of the Academy of Arts and Sciences said they were going to commit to doubling the number of women and diverse members of the Academy by 2020. Here's the former president of the Academy, Cheryl Boone Isaacs, discussing the need for diversity at the 2016 Oscars.
Our audiences are global and rich in diversity, and every facet of our industry should be as well. Everyone in the Hollywood community has a role to play in bringing about the vital changes the industry needs so that we can accurately reflect the world today.
But not much has changed. Cynthia Erivo was the only person of color nominated in any of the four acting categories for her performance as Harriet Tubman. And in another glaring absence, there were also, once again, no women nominated in the Best Director category. One of the films shut out by the Oscars was The Farewell, directed by Lulu Wang. Back in July, The Takeaway spoke with Wang, and she told us about the direction she wants to see Hollywood move towards.
I just think that we have to show a wide array of different stories, regardless of what ethnicity, you know, whatever. It's all about just the specificity and allowing people to tell their own stories.
Joining me now are Allison Wilmore, film critic at Vulture and New York Magazine, and Soraya McDonald, culture critic for ESPN's The Undefeated. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Oh, a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So lots of talk about Oscars So White, Oscars So Male, lots of talk about who got snubbed and who didn't. Soraya, a lot of people were predicting supporting actress nomination for J-Lo, Jennifer Lopez in Hustlers. Why do you think she didn't make it?
Well, I think, you know, as much as we've talked about this effort to change the makeup of the Academy, that progress is actually moving along quite slowly. And, you know, one of the things that I noticed about J-Lo in Hustlers is that she is, you know, subverting sort of like a long-held awards trope, because for years and years, you know, one of the ways that women could get an Oscar nomination for themselves was by playing a stripper with a heart of gold or a sex worker with a heart of gold, someone who, like, does a job involving taking her clothes off and also has a heart of gold. And, you know, J-Lo's character in Hustlers is far more complicated than that. She's a bit of an anti-hero. Like, she's pretty ethically compromised, but still, like, really interesting to watch in the way that, you know, we have come to see as normal for, say, leads of movies like The Irishman. But I think because she is not necessarily playing to the idea of what we usually think of when we think of a stripper in a movie, I think she was punished for that a bit by the acting segment of the Academy that just, like, didn't appreciate what she was doing in that movie.
Allison, Glenn Mazzara, who's the creator, as you know, of The Walking Dead, tweeted this after the Oscar noms. He says, quote, "Call me crazy, but I believe that white men, feeling threatened by recent pushes to hire more women and people of color, are not voting for films made by those people because that would validate those films and create a shift in the marketplace." Should be noted that Mazzara is white and male. What do you make of that comment?
You know, it's so hard to guess what's on the mind of Oscars, you know, except for when there are occasional anonymous Oscar ballot interviews, which are often horrifying, by the way. I think that what you have to kind of figure is there are a lot of people who I think, if not consciously pushing back, I think also see, like, well, we've taken care of this problem now. You know, I don't have to think about it anymore. And I think you see some really prominent artists and voting members be like, well, I don't think that diversity is something that should count. It should be about quality. As though quality
Stephen
were
King
Stephen King this
yes.
morning. Yes, mm-hmm. The favorite of the internet this
yes.
morning.
Yes.
You know, but I think you see in that this kind of assumption that taste is neutral and exists outside of someone's experiences and identity. And it's really frustrating to see that again and people being like, well, I just voted for what was good, and to assume that that means that that exists in a vacuum.
And that what was good this year included, or at least quote unquote good, included The Irishman, 1917, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and very, very little diversity. I mean, we know that according to USC Annenberg's Inclusion Initiative, 2019 was a banner year for top grossing movies directed by women, 13-year high, but they're still only 10%, and the numbers are much lower for women of color. Soraya, why can they still get shut out?
You know, I think part of it is that there's not a respect there for the work that female directors do. I do think that there is some legitimacy to the idea that, you know, these guys who basically sort of make up the voting membership of the director's wing of the Academy have sort of created a club for themselves. And it is, you know, quite possibly the, you know, He-Man, Woman-Hating Club. No girls allowed. It certainly looks that way when you look at this year's nominations. But there were so many, like, phenomenally directed films that were made by women filmmakers this past year, whether it was Greta Gerwig with Little Women, Mariel Heller with A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, Atlantics by Madi Jope.
These were all films that have been part of the conversation for months already. It's not like these were like obscure films that were made. I mean, do the Oscars still matter? And I'm going to get your take, Allison, on that as well. But do the Oscars still matter? I mean, some people just say, you know what, enough. We don't need this anymore, particularly for creators of color.
Yes, I think they do. Institutions can and should evolve and quickly. We're basically leading up to the 92nd presentation of the Oscars. So even if, you know, there is this new award that sort of arises as like a corrective to that, it's not really seen as the same thing, right? It's like reactionary. Like, this is the body and the award that has been created supposedly to celebrate the sort of annual best in film. And that means, you know, that we should take it as such.
So, Allison, I want to ask you the same question. Do the Oscars still matter? And I say this because there's been so much blowback to people just saying, you know what, just do your own thing. Like, why are these things so important? But do they still matter?
Well, they are obviously an enormous platform. You know, there's a reason that studios still spend really grotesque amounts of money on Oscar campaigns. And it's because of how visible this award is, what it can mean in terms of benefiting the studio financially, but also in terms of future work that people get to do, in terms of the ramifications that kind of, like, you know, reverberate through the industry when these prizes are handed out. It's really hard to kind of read how directly that is. But I think in that case, yes. For me, the Oscars have very rarely lined up with my personal favorite films of the year. And often when you look back in history, the films from a year we talk about are not the Oscar winners. And I think it's important to remember that and to maybe always think of the Oscars as most accurately reflecting how the industry views itself at that particular moment. And I think they are very valuable in terms of that. I think that they are this very warped, interesting and often troubling reflection, Hollywood's reflection on itself. And in that way, I do think they're valuable.
And it almost, that's a perfect segue into my next question, which is that The Joker received the most nominations this year, 11 noms. The Irishman, 1917, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, all got 10 nominations. Scarlett Johansson was nominated twice.
Yes.
I mean, why do you think these were the films that connected most with the Academy in 2019? Because we talk a lot about the nominations, but the Academy itself is also relatively, and I'm being generous here, white and male, right? Did that also have something to do with this, you think?
I don't think it was deliberate that a lot of these films have been extremely grounded in not just like a male experience and a white male experience, but also feelings of sometimes control, like, you know, fear of control going away from these white male characters, of time passing. I think that's just an interesting coincidence. But the fact that they all resonated so much with the Academy membership is, I think, also unsurprising and maybe telling. Joker, I find it a frustrating win because I think in some ways it is a portion of Hollywood's ideal, which is that it is a really popular film. You know, it was a massively successful box office hit, but it's also a film that makes some gestures towards like serious cinema, you know, this very method acting, references Martin Scorsese. So I think that there is some Oscar voter who thinks that that is the future of the Academy Awards, something that throws back to the past while also making gestures to the popular present.
Soraya, the only person of color to receive an acting nomination this year was Cynthia Erivo for playing Harriet Tubman. I'm going to ask you how telling that nomination is in terms of the types of roles that the Academy has been willing to recognize Black actors for.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's very telling. You know, there have been a number of actors, of Black actors, who have made this observation that when it comes to recognition from the Academy, there is definitely this preference for roles that require Black actors to somehow put themselves in positions that are often seen as demeaning or degrading, not particularly dignified. You know, either they're enslaved people or maids, or, you know, in the case of Monique, just a really sort of hellacious mother. So that's really disappointing because, you know, part of what that communicates is that they're not necessarily seeing the craft in a role like Alfre Woodard's in Clemency or in Lupita Nyong'o's in Us. And that's tremendously disappointing, right? Because, I mean, sort of in the popular imagination, these awards exist to say, hey, like, you know, look at the great work that these folks are doing. And then, you know, you look at the performances that were nominated in some of these acting categories, and it doesn't really quite match up.
Allison Wilmore is a film critic at Vulture and New York Magazine, and Soraya McDonald is culture critic for ESPN's The Undefeated. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, that's it for us today, but I have a bit of news from me to end today's show. Starting January 27th, if not sooner, I'll be embarking on a new adventure, motherhood. So I'll be taking some time off to have and care for my little bundle of joy. It's a big and exciting change for me, and I'll definitely miss being with you while I'm away. But while I'm sorting through bottles and diapers and onesies, an exciting roster of great journalists will be filling in for me, starting with Arun Venugopal, my colleague here at WNYC. And The Takeaway will continue to bring you the sharp analysis and smart takes on the news, culture, and more that you rely on us for. As for me, I'll still be listening and watching on Twitter. I'm at Tanzina Vega, and I'll be back in the host chair later this spring. So I hope you keep listening to us, too, and keep sending us your comments and ideas for the show. But I'm not gone yet. Tomorrow we'll be back with our usual lineup of stories you need to hear and much, much more. Until then, I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.